today on Building the Open Metaverse.
Really, it comes down to what the resources are they have or familiarity. I mean, if you're a company that has been funded, you're building a game, you've got a lot of engineers that know Unreal or Unity, you should probably spend a bit of time there. Here's the thing. If I have the engineers and resources and funding, I have a time constraint that money has to be spent to build a product at the end of the day. I can't spend a ton of time trying to get into a new engine with engineers who aren't familiar with it and that kind of overhead. So it may not make sense for them, you know, in open source. But what they can do is if they decide that they want to use these engines, you know, any of them, maybe there's a module that they like from Godot or a module that they like from O3D that can serve their purpose. So the thing is, people think it's an all or nothing end game, but it's not.
Welcome to Building the Open Metaverse, where technology experts discuss how the community is building the open metaverse together. Hosted by Patrick Cozy from Cesium and Mark Petit from Epic Games.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. Welcome to Building the Open Metaverse, the podcast where technologists share their insight on how the community is building the metaverse together. I'm Mark Petit from Epic Games. I'm here with my co-host, Patrick Cozy. Hello, Patrick.
Hi, Mark. Hi, everybody.
And today we have two special guests. And, you know, if ever we're going to be on message, it's today because, you know, we want to talk about building the open metaverse and we know how important game engine and graphics engine are to metaverse and how important open source and open standards will play in building the open metaverse. And so we're extremely lucky to have with us the two mastermind behind two open source game engines that I'm going to introduce to you. We'll start with Royal O'Brien, representing O3DE. Royal, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And I think your title is GM of Digital Media and Games at the Linux Foundation.
That's correct. That's exactly it.
And you were formerly chief evangelist in the game tech division of Amazon, where you were involved with Lumberyard. So maybe you'll explain to us some lineage between Lumberyard and O3DE. Also have the immense pleasure to have you done Juan Linietsky, who is the head of development at Godot. You're actually the creator and the lead developer of the Godot game engine. And welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And so we're super happy to have both of you with us. And so we would like you to describe your journey to the metaverse. Patrick, who do we start with?
Juan, do you want to start?
Sure. I'm not exactly sure what I could add to the conversation, but if you have any topic I could start with, that would be great.
Well, how did you get to create an open source game engine? Maybe that would be a good, understand your motivation and your background there.
The story of Godot is a bit weird, maybe. It used to be an in-house game engine for companies I had in South America. And when I didn't do game development anymore, I just put it on GitHub as open source. It was quite mature because it was used for like a couple dozen titles at the time, but it wasn't something that you could say it was like more like a product, right? It was more like an in-house tool. So people started working on it year over year, and after a couple of years, it started getting really popular, like lots of downloads, like really huge community. It was a very little by little process of just like getting more and more people involved and trying to synchronize everybody so they could like have community reporting bugs and asking for features and other contributors adding things. No, this is a very community developed project. I mean, there's not really any entity behind. It's very chaotic. I think probably the most interesting part you could say about the way Godot is developed in the open is that we don't really pay anybody to do anything. I mean, we have a lot of donations and a lot of hired people who contribute, but we don't really pay anybody to do anything. It's mostly like things happen just because there's so many people contributing that eventually somebody will work on what is needed and then it will be integrated. It's not like, okay, we need this and we decided, right? It's more like somebody is like, I made this, please integrate it. And of course, it has to pass a lot of filters and you have to make everybody agree and everybody has to be like, okay, we really want this, right? So it's a very bureaucratic and tedious process, and maybe getting something into the engine can take months. But it's very, very, it works really well. It's very brute force, you could say, in the way it works. But it's very community-oriented. I mean, there's not really an authority deciding how things are going to be done or what the next steps are going to be. It's all very, you could say, organic. But I'm very happy, like, to work this way. It's very, very interesting and very different to anything I've done before.
So Juan, I mean, first, thank you for all your contributions to the open source community. And I mean, congrats on all the success you had. It's quite remarkable. You know, as part of your origin story here, can you tell us a bit about the community and how it's grown and evolved and kind of the scale that you're executing at now?
Well, yeah, the community is really scaling a lot. It's very, very challenging to scale the amount of community because there's really way too many contributors, like more than almost 2,000 people contributing to the engine and probably 100 doing it like actively, like all the time.
That's a great problem.
It's a very good problem to have, but it's very challenging. A lot of time you are not able to give enough attention to people who want to contribute because you just don't have the resources. So that happens very often, and we wish it didn't happen so much. But at the same time, we don't have the resources to just like check what everybody is doing and what our contributions are done. Like, so in the end, we focus more maybe on bug fixes and these things, and then features take more time to get added because there really needs to be a lot of consensus to move forward with anything other related. But it's a very interesting problem. I haven't really seen many open source projects that are made this way. You could say most of them have a large company behind or something like that, but in the case of Godot, because it's so organic, It's very, very difficult to manage, but it's a good problem. I mean, we do everything like very brute force-ish, you could say. I mean, having myself many companies in the past, it's completely different because it's a way where like you can't tell anybody. I mean, contributors to open source for a project like this work on what they want, when they want, and how they want. And you have to like get used to it and organize. So what they do is useful. So there's lots of discussions, lots of agreement, lots of like seeking for consensus. But in the end, it works really well. It's like you could say it's like a market developed like open source project because it's all the little guys pushing together rather than just one big entity. So it works really well to me. It's very, very interesting.
This actually reminds me of how the Blender Foundation is working, which in contrast is very different to the Linux Foundation, right, Royal? So maybe, Royal, you want to give us a little bit of a, you know, an aperçu of your personal journey and then kind of contrast, you know, how the Linux Foundation and O3D is approaching an open source game engine.
Certainly. So I started quite a few years over at Amazon. And I came into the lumberyard division at the time when they were just basically, you know, showing different companies, hey, here's this 3D engine. You can use it. It's free. But if you want to build something that uses cloud services, you'll need to use AWS. So people are always kind of looking for that hook as to, well, what other hooks are there? And so it made people really skittish of using it. A handful of places, I learned more, and I still learn to this day, more companies that wound up using it that we just never knew. Projects like I'll talk to them like, yeah, we have this rover program that actually simulates what it's like in going in caverns in Mars. And I'm like, where's that been? I've been working on that for years. I'm like, I never heard of that. Yeah, we never talked to anybody about it. So I spent a lot of time with them and then the internal studios that were building games inside of Amazon, kind of championing that, taking a look at what are people really want. But really what it came down to was the adoption was still problematic because people were kind of skittish about it, you know, the licensing and things like that. So it came up in a conversation of, well, let's look at how do we open source this? You know, how do we get this to a larger market, you know? I'm not part of Amazon, but at the time, it was, look, we, you know, Amazon knows how to compete in the cloud space. So why try to compete in the engine space when they could just literally give it to everybody? So going open source was actually, you know, pretty easy understanding that if you can give it to everybody and everybody starts to use it, then you can compete what you're really good at. Which is cloud services, and they've done that. So the task was then put off to me, you know, as a single-threaded owner, to take this and form everything around it and build this into an open source solution? You had to do the business, fiscal, marketing. How is it going to be from top to bottom? It's very different than what Juan's talking about, because there was a lot to go through. So did all that, spent quite a bit of time. And the first thing that really came out, though, was will it be viable technologically? And then will it be viable in the market? And technologically, the problem was that it was so spaghetti coded from its origins, which remember, it's basically from the Crytek branch where you had games like Far Cry. And, you know, this is an engine that's had millions of games sold on it, right? There's no question for its origins. But decoupling that, making it into something more modular that the actual open source community can dive into was the viable thing. So that was the first part of it. Getting it so that it was viable, putting it on standard open source tools like CMake, getting it off of the proprietary things, getting all of that out, and then putting it into a license model that anyone can actually do something with. And that's why we went with Apache and MIT. So that was the key. And then forming the strategy of not just how will we put it out in open source, but how will we work with other projects who want to use things that we've done, or we may use some pieces that they've done. It's the funny thing is people always ask with O3D, you know, are you competing? And in open source, you're not competing. You're actually free to and freely giving everything away, including to other projects, because if they enhance them and make them better, they wind up coming back. So after going through all of that, I wound up talking to a handful of companies. I thought, if we're going to get this engine off the ground and moving, let's look at how can we get it properly funded, you know, get a team behind it. And my background, I've built and exited from four different companies. So, you know, as an entrepreneur over 20 years, I kind of knew how to do this. And so that's what I did. Basically built it kind of like a company, except it doesn't really have a customer that it's selling to per se. It's being given to the world, but how do you build that support system underneath of it to actually build a viable product that can grow rapidly? And so that's what realistically happened. We built it, we put it out, we launched it, we made sure it was clear messaging as to where it was in its maturity, this way not to mislead anybody. And from there, it's grown from where it started at least tenfold of where we've been, where, you know, we have about 500 people that are online in Discord. That was one of the changes. Instead of going to kind of like mailing lists and traditional email, we actually put everything in Discord first, because that's where you find a lot of communities now. And by doing that, it created such rapid iteration that we had engineers and contributors that were coming in going, hey, there's a problem right here. Oh, I just fixed that, or a conversation. So it really allowed us to do fast iteration. The other part about this was that instead of it being chaotic, actually formed all the special interest groups around it, because there's so many modules and pieces. Somebody who's talking about build systems may not know anything about graphics or sound systems. So building those special interest groups, those micro communities, was an essential piece so that the support structure, when somebody comes in, and we see this every day, somebody come into General and say, I have a problem with X. And instead of it becoming this tragedy of wall of text like Twitch, they say, go over to this SIG and talk to them. And they wind up getting about 15 people that respond exactly with what they're looking for in the tool. So that's been essential. And then putting together the technical steering committee behind it so that we can actually look at what are the features that we want to move forward, what are the features that people are looking for. And this is all driven by the community as well. That's the thing. So as much as we have companies involved and they're funding it, they're not the ones that make the decisions on where the technology goes. That's driven by the community. But they support the marketing and fiscal so that we can grow that and attract more people. So that's why we've had so much growth so quickly. And it's a very structured thing. You'll see that we have open calendars. Anybody can jump on the meetings at any time, participate. There's a formal RFC process. So a lot of the formal pieces, the building blocks of building a community, which in this case is very similar to kind of building a company that'll support itself, was put in place so that we can have that rapid growth and allow people to do that. And, you know, as an example, Patrick was able to, they were able to stand something up incredibly fast on the platform and get exactly what they needed right there within, you know, minutes or hours of asking. And by having that process of having that steering committee and the SIGs making those decisions, that means a feature comes in, we can do it really fast. We can have it come in inside of weeks or months where we know these are the modules that came in, the SIGs themselves approve these modules to come in. The TSC agrees that we're going to put all of these in on our next release. The release board does it. It happens in the testing cycle. So the big difference is that, yes, there's a lot of chaos going around, but it is organized into channels where those channels actually give us decision power to look at what do we want to do with the roadmap to move forward.
Yeah. And you're leaning on the process and the infrastructure of the Linux Foundation, right? Which we heard from the Academy Software Foundation on this podcast a few weeks ago. They also lean on that infrastructure. So I think it's pretty beneficial to get up to speed quickly, in fact.
Yeah, having the tools like the LFX tools that we use that give us kind of all of the insight, what's happening with the project, who's contributing. The biggest thing about a project I know is that you may have small pockets of erosion where nobody's paying attention to it. A lot of those tools will tell us where the attention's going and where it's not going and where we need to raise some awareness so that you don't have something that's built and it's doing wonderful, but then come to find out that its underlying support system has been eroding out and you'd have to wind up doing a rewrite.
So a little bit of a dive into the technology. How would you describe it? I mean, we call those game engines. Are they really game engines? You know, how would you, maybe Juan, you know, how would you describe what your technology does? Especially, you know, a theme that comes back on this conversation is how, as the web becomes more powerful in terms of graphics, you know, how potentially, you know, do you see the future, the role of a Godot on the web or on the future on the web or those kind of a new platform? So how would you describe Godot in the specificities of Godot?
So I think on the website, the actual technologies are coming along very nicely. I think there's going to be a turning point where you have technologies like WebAssembly and WebGPU are mainstream, and you can use them like everybody can use them, and this will really allow to put like really complex game engines on the web. I think, unfortunately, for now, Apple is kind of delaying this a bit because on their browsers and platforms, it's a bit limited. Like, you just can't use like the latest things. Like WebAssembly with read support and everything is like working very nicely on Chrome and Firefox, but Safari is still a bit behind. So I think we are still probably a year or two away. I mean, Apple is working on it and they are doing their best, but you can tell that they are still a bit behind because they probably don't have like as big of a browser team or something like that. But I think at some point it's going to be great because you will be able to put like a really complex game or game engine on the web and run anything you want. Right now, Godot still works really well on the web. It uses WebGL2 and it uses WebAssembly without thread support because that doesn't work in all browsers. It's okay. It's still a bit limited. I mean, there's lots of games being published with Godot to that platform using itch.io and everything. But yeah, I think still it's probably still maybe a year or two away from being a technology that can be used for something like this. On the other hand, like for example, one thing what we got asked a lot in Godot is that it's used a lot in schools. I think especially high schools. There's a lot of schools in the US using it for teaching programming because Godot is like has a very, very strong focus on accessibility and ease of use. It has its own scripting language, its own like code editor, and everything is very laid in a way that is very easy to understand, very easy to use. So it's a great platform for learning, and many schools in the US use it for this. So, for example, one thing they asked is that because they use it already on iPads and Chromebooks, that we can run it on the web. So we have a very nice grant from the Mozilla Foundation, and thanks to it, we could hire our networking and web contributors. So Godot now works. Like you can make games on the web using Godot, which works really well. Of course, you can do something super complex because running on the web, the editor of the engine is a bit limited. But for teaching programming, it works really, really good. So I think it's something that is getting there on their respect of like really running complex content. I think WebGPU is amazing. It's a really well thought out specification. I think due to politics, it's probably took much longer than what would be nice that it took. But on the other hand, the nice thing is that maybe the kind of hardware it's aiming for wasn't like widespread when it was proposed, but now it is. So I think in the end it's coming out at a good time because like the DirectX 12 and Vulkan level hardware was not widespread enough before, and now it's everywhere. So I think it's like things are converging where I think what you could say was attempted like maybe a decade ago of making everything web. That didn't work back then, so most companies and everybody went apps. I think it's probably when all these technologies are finalized going to finally like give a second chance to all this, and that's going to have like very deep implications because it's going to be much more accessible to just use anything that is out there, like any kind of game, any kind of platform. That will be really, really amazing. I'm very much looking forward to the next years.
And Juan, just a quick follow-up for 3D on the web. You know, when WebAssembly and WebGPU are there, do you think that the existing C++ game engines will just be able to work on the web, or do you think there's going to be a lot of changes that are necessary inside the main C++ baseline, you know, to get a great experience on the web?
I don't think there's need to be many changes from my experience. The main problem is, like, just to give you a very simple example, one of the main problems we have with game engines running on the current version of WebAssembly and WebGL2 is that on one side, like, for example, if you want to mix audio and just, like, do game audio, generally you need to run audio on a thread and then needs to mix, like, so we have, like, very low latency with audio. And with the current web GPU, you can't really do it because it's just single thread. And then if you want to compensate, you have to either write your own backend in HTML5, which is very limiting because you can't use the engine one. Or you have to mix the audio on the same thread that you're running the game, so you can have problems with the audio, like cracking or something like that. So, and then you have WebGL2, which is a very old standard, which is based on hardware that came out in maybe 15 years ago, which is really limiting. You can't do anything modern with it. You can maybe do simple 3D on it, but it's like cell phone style from like maybe 5 years ago at much. So it's very limiting what you can do with it. You can't do like modern 3D graphics very nicely with it. So right now it's kind of limiting, but my feeling is that when we can get WebAssembly with proper threads, which for need, I think, I mean, this is not Apple's fault. What happened is that the Spectre vulnerability came up, and then suddenly, like, all the shared array buffers from HTML5 implementations were, like, prone to that attack. So they had to block and rewritten in a way which where they were better sandboxed, and that was a huge investment for the browsers. And all this delayed everything. So I think now that things are finally getting together, I think it's going to be very, very great because you can pretty much do anything. You can port any application to the web now that is written in C++ or any modern language like Rust or Go or anything like that should run like perfectly without any changes on the web. And that's going to be really amazing. I think that's probably going to change a lot on the way we see the web.
So Royal, how would you describe, in contrast with O3D and the platforms that you target, and I mean the web and the cloud, I think, go kind of hand in hand. I'm sure you have some very specific views on there.
So I mean, you know, in regard to like with O3D, the first part of it, it was targeted for Mac, PC, iOS, Android, Linux. But understand that, you know, it is C++, but it's completely modular. So in other words, it's not like where I compile one module and I have to eat the entire thing. The other part we're talking about here is that if you wind up looking at a lot of engines that are out there traditionally, the renderer is coded into everything on the engine. There's a lot of hooks that go along with it. So it's not like you can detach the renderer away from it without untying a lot of code. That's traditionally, yeah, especially like within the editor. But that's the funny thing. Look at O3DE. If somebody decides to build a web GPU renderer, you literally can shut off the rendering gem and turn on a web gem, web GPU gem, and you're still operational. So in other words, you don't have those kind of impacts. And that's going to be really important when we're talking about modularity of pieces and making it as small as possible. Because if somebody doesn't need all of that excess code, all of those excess pieces, you definitely don't want those to be, linked all together. So that's a big piece. So, are we looking at, you know, web-based targets and such. Absolutely. And I mean, everything Juan's talking about is you know, spot on. And a lot of the stuff they're doing, like with the schools and the stuff with Godot, is fantastic because it's a great entry point for them to come in. O3D is a little bit different in that perspective where, you know, the scripting language between having like Lua or C++ or the visual scripting where you can just basically pull nodes and put them together like what they do in, I think it's Minecraft, where you can actually block logic together by tying nodes and lines together. You know, it's a different area, but you're compiling it. It's made for different applications. It's where you use the right tool for the right job. So, you know, as we're moving towards towards web, the thing is, the other part is all of these different modules have got to be able to work kind of like asynchronously, because if you have a lot of data flowing through, just like Juan's talking about, as soon as you're talking about blocking threads, trying to pull things in or manipulate, it's going to fall over and die. And if we're starting to talk about, you know, in the context of metaverse and for large scale, it's a lot of data that must be done asynchronously. I mean, I don't know about you, but when's the last time you saw an MMO that you were running around in the field that locked up your entire screen because somebody with level 50 horse came around in level 1 area? These things pop in asynchronously. So those are really critical, and having that as an underlying foundation for the entire engine is a big piece. So, you know, we've looked at some of these pieces to try and future-proof what are the issues that are going to be coming around for what we can for right now. You know, and then when you're also looking at the targets, I mean, you've got native, and then you're going to have web. I'm super excited as well with WebAssembly and WebGPU. But again, we have limitations that we're dealing with and how to get there. And then, of course, the community embracing it. The other thing is going to be, though, how you're going to do interoperability with all the different 3D mesh formats and structures and things like those are going to cause a lot of problems, because now we've got color space differences. We have texture format differences. We have, you know, what it's on. So it's never just a simple problem of how it's going to come out, because we've already seen, even with the Atom renderer, you know, given a couple different resources with different inputs, it's PBR and I got 6 channels, but it can still come out wrong in every way, shape, or form. So, you know, those are a lot of the pieces that, instead of just looking at, okay, how can we get to the destination target, it's how can we make sure all of the tools of being able to build this experience are mature enough that somebody can build it? Because nobody wants to play the game of building a game. They want to build the game.
Yeah, well said. And look, I mean, congrats to both of you on all the community adoption and momentum. And, you know, when we think about game engines, you know, we see them as really real-time 3D engines. And, you know, with the metaverse, we see real-time 3D everywhere, right? Maybe one day it's your web browser, one day it's your operating system. And I'm curious, when both of you look at the landscape of these 3D engines, especially with Unity and Unreal, I mean, how do you see, you know, slotting in the open source, and like, what are there certain use cases where the community kind of goes to the open source? Or certain markets. So maybe Royal, do you want to start?
Sure. So really it comes down to what the resources are they have or familiarity. I mean, if you're a company that has been funded, you're building a game, you've got a lot of engineers that know Unreal or Unity, you should probably spend a bit of time there. If here's the thing. If I have the engineers and resources and funding, I have a time constraint that money has to be spent to build a product at the end of the day. I can't spend a ton of time trying to get into a new engine with engineers who aren't familiar with it and that kind of overhead. So it may not make sense for them, you know, in open source. But what they can do is, if they decide that they want to use these engines, you know, any of them, maybe there's a module that they like from Godot or a module that they like from O3D that can serve their purpose. So the thing is, people think it's an all or nothing end game, but it's not, because you should be able to use the pieces from open source, build upon them, and contribute back. That helps open source. It also helps accelerate your project. Or if you have a project that's out there, you want to cut the technical debt down of having to rewrite a stack, like a network stack, you could actually use one of the open source implementations, interfacing them in. So how is that going to play in the future? I would say try not to look at open source as an all or nothing game. But as the pieces that somebody actually needs to accomplish what they need to get done. Now, you know, will it be mature, where it'll be the preferred thing or not? That's going to be an independent decision of, you know, who's out there. In my view, I love the idea of having commercial and open source working closely together at all times, you know, doing modules that are compatible with each other. It helps everybody at the end of the day, because there are strengths and weaknesses that are always going to come out. And it's a cat and mouse game. It always is.
That's interesting perspective. I think this idea, when the response is commercial or open source and the response is mix and match, it's actually a very interesting prospect. I'll need to think about that as the Unreal Engine guy on the show today. So,
Royal, you know, on the podcast, we're big fans of interoperability and open standards. And, you know, I think we forgot to mention in your intro, but, you know, thank you for joining us at this last SIGGRAPH, the session that really kicked off this podcast.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun talking about the metaverse, because it was interesting where you have a lot of people that are talking about all the technology in the metaverse. But the reality is that if you don't have that standardized format of how are you going to deal with intellectual property, how are you going to deal with interchange, the engine doesn't even matter to the metaverse, because there's going to be some new and improved engine, you know, open3d.go engine that somebody will form out of somewhere that we never knew in 3-4 years that can be used on the metaverse. So the reality is that it's how do we get the right interoperability to allow companies and open source and people to develop content rapidly in this metaverse and be able to share it in an orderly manner. You know, if you look at like what the studios are trying to do with intellectual property of what's out there, they're trying to find a way where they're able to share, but also, you know, make revenues where it is appropriate. This is going to be a resounding thing that happens over and over on the metaverse. So a lot of that standardization has to be, you know, and I can say that, you know, I'm spending a lot of time in this specific area looking at, you know, the open metaverse, how to actually build an open metaverse that's based around the standards where everybody can play in that sandbox, you know, build what they want or make what they want. That's that sustained balanced ecosystem that has to exist, and how we've wound up creating what we have today with the web on the internet.
Juan, any perspectives you want to share on open standards, interoperability, and, you know, the open source and commercial game engines?
So I think there's a couple of things there that came to mind from the very interesting things that Royal said. So one thing I see a lot with Godot is that there really is a big demand for open source in the game development community, you could say. If you compare maybe when Linux came out, it took a while until Linux was like up to task to replace you could say a lot of the commercial offerings that you could say compete, but they don't really compete, but offer the same. Like it took like a long time to Linux to you could say to be on the same level. On the other side, what we see is that there's a lot of companies approach us and they really want to use Godot and it's open source and everything, mostly because what interests them is exactly what Royal said, is like they can take the game engine and they can just modify it to fit whatever they need, and then they don't have to, because we use a very, like, you could say, we Godot is not copyleft, it's MIT, so you can do just whatever you want with it, just like with O3D. So like, for example, you have the example that Sega came and they took Godot and they just modified it and they ported like Sonic colors to it, and they used to release a new Sonic game on it, and they like did really heavy changes to it. They didn't give them back, which is fine, because that's what I believe that should be, because games are not software. Are not in the same category. And that worked really well. It's like, it's not like it just, we don't expect especially the biggest companies to just use Godot stock and release a game. A lot of them do, but a lot of them just take whatever they need and release, and that's super, super important to me. It's just as Real said. So the other thing that's very interesting to me on the metaverse aspect is that I will give you an example, and I think you will be pretty happy about it, Patrick, because you were very familiar with this. Like, for example, I think when GLTF2 was released, you probably remember I wrote an article about why it's like the best format for Exchange that I have seen in years, like lots of really good decisions in there, like way too many good decisions that were problematic. Like I worked many years like implementing Colada in commercial game engines and everything, and there were so many things that were made it so complicated that are not there in GLTF2. So it's super important. So at the beginning, when we implemented GLTF2 in Godot, we just made it an import format. You know, it's just you put the file in there, it imports and uses the internal Godot file. So when you export, of course, going to use the Godot optimized file that's going to be more optimized for a game. So we didn't really add any kind of support for like just loading those files in real time, because adding the GLTF2 loader in real time wouldn't make any sense, just was an importer. But the past few years, that completely changed. You know, it's like, for example, just to give you very, very simple examples from the guys making like NFT games that let you like own a piece of an asset. They really want to be able to just load and share GLTF2 files because that can be something that has value and you can trade it. But even from their companies like Oculus with the new OpenXR APIs, when you want to download, like, for example, the control model so you can see the controller that you're moving with your hand, all that is also real-time GLTF2. And we continually see more and more demand for, like, loading and sending these kind of formats in real-time. And it has some really difficult challenges, like, for example, you don't use the same format for compressed textures on mobile and on desktop, so you can't just use the same model. There are some interesting libraries. I can't remember the name of this, that one acquired by Google. There's this library that has like an intermediate format that you can convert to. I can't remember the name, but I think GLTF2 supports it. Right. So that works really well, but right now the quality is kind of poor. So it works okay, but not great quality. But it's getting there like little by little. So it seems there's still some technical like hurdles that need to be solved for this, but it has changed in the past few years like a lot, and we see that from our users that they really want to focus on formats that they can just exchange and everything. So that's what I see, that is like it's super important to have like asset formats like that are like very easy to share, very optimized. Like if you open an FBX model in Godot, it may take like 30 seconds, but GLTF2 takes like maybe 1 second because it's all optimized already, all binary. So it's super important to have this kind of open formats for this kind of metaverse, you could say, goals. So the other thing that I think may be a bit more problematic on the metaverse side is that in my experience, when you want to, I mean, if you are looking, because there's like lots of definitions of metaverse, I suppose, but if you're looking at the movie definition, like Ready Player One, where you have all these worlds connected and everything, I think the biggest problem that needs to be addressed by technology right now is that the problem, but when you make an experience where you have players that connect, there's always a problem of who has the authority on what's going on, right? That's kind of a problem because you need to tell who has the authority of what's going on. Otherwise, anybody can cheat or claim that they have something they don't have. And this is a really difficult problem that I think is probably the key of what needs to be solved in order to move forward. Because with all the decentralization and everything, you can kind of solve a bit of that. But I believe that for now, it looks like there wasn't really a solution on how you can actually like solve that. Because if you make, like, for example, if you make a multiplayer game and you want to like make money out of it, the biggest problem is that you need to have an authoritative server, like something that is hosted on the cloud in a computer, like that is controlled by the one who made the game. So you can make sure that like nobody's going to do something that is not supposed to do, like any kind of cheating or using any kind of something like that. So everything needs to be validated. And all the games, like all the big games, like, I don't know, League of Legends or Fortnite or anything like that, that have this kind of really multiplayer experiences require this really expensive servers in order to run. So it's very difficult to like to tell how you can validate. So I think right now the biggest challenge for something like an open metaverse, and this is I think very important also from the open source game engines, is figuring how we can do a technology that can let you have like validate everything going on without actually requiring an actual server to do it that is owned by an entity. That I think that's the biggest challenge, maybe for very simple games that nowadays use crypto and this kind of thing. Maybe you can sort of solve it because you can have like a hash ownership or something like that. But for something more complex, it seems like there isn't an answer yet for that, and there's not a lot of research on it. I think that's where probably things need to be focusing more in the future.
Yeah, I think to kind of parlay on that too, if you take a look at the history of what we've done, we started out, if you remember, Web 1.0 was where everybody's going to have a server and everybody was going to have a client, right? We're going to decentralize everything. And come to find out, people didn't want to host their own servers, so we wound up to Web 2.0, which is where we are now. But then you have Web 3, which is part of that going back to decentralization. But unfortunately, which is exactly what I'm talking about, you know, trying to do these servers, I can tell you right now you can play the game, but your cell phone is going to burn up in fire if you decide to become a hash node for a crypto. And it's that's the reality. And so, you know, until you're able to get that kind of horsepower that's in a distributed manner that can be trusted, and there's a lot of security holes that are in there if you really poke around at it, that's going to be where we want decentralization. But the reality is that it's not possible right now. Will it be in the future? Sure. I mean, I can remember some of the fun stuff that I was writing with the, you know, we're talking about jumping from instance to instance, like world to world. We were having fun. We had this the stuff we were working on, the Quake 1 and Quake 2 engine, long time ago when it was really fun to do that. And where you would literally be playing on one map and we had a portal. And as you approach the portal, it would actually replicate your state node to another server. And when you hit the portal, it literally threw you to another server where you had a whole bunch of new players. And it was that kind of, it was that idea that we were doing, and this was what, in the late 90s, early 2000, that we were doing that. And so it's got to be, you know, how is that stuff going to exchange? But again, who's the authority? Because we were going from dedicated server to dedicated server, and that's a whole different arena right there. And the other part is that to kind of tee off with the GLTF2 is that if you look at it, having the kind of standard, like we're working really closely with the Kronos Group to make sure that a lot of the standards of, like, you know, Vulkan and OpenXR and things like that, that we're actually adhering to them to become kind of like you know, a reference where somebody can learn how to use it and to make sure that they're being continually updated with new and advanced things. So it's that great feedback loop that we get, because if you don't have that standards org or that formal body that's helping move it forward, I mean, let's look at it. Email is still unencrypted to this day, 30 years ago. We just have layers on top of it, all right? But yet, how long did it take WhatsApp to get something moved from no encryption to end-to-end encryption? You know, maybe a year? So understand that having these kind of standards bodies are really critical, because technology inherently moves slow, and community needs and demands are incredibly fast. And so you've got to be able to keep up with them, or else we will see, you know, what's happened. I mean, if you watch people trying to share video on IRC, that's a fun one, and that's been around forever and a day. Yet you can go on, you know, Slack and pop a new emoji from your face in there and have a nice day. So, you know, having those kind of things that are in there are actually pretty, pretty critical for how this will succeed going forward.
Yeah. And that's one of the things we're trying to champion, and it's a theme that we're hearing, like, around the role of Kronos and the potential of GLTF, and we're actually trying to, you know, working with Kronos and accelerate, you know, and try to be very concrete. It looks like GLTF is a very strong base that we can extend. You know, there's another strong base, which is USD, which is non-open standard, it's open source, but it's a brilliant piece of engineering. So the question is, how do we get concretely moving and, like, make progress in 2022 around that interoperability agenda, and, you know, solving both the technological problem, the governance problem, because, as you said, you know, and proper governance is inherently slow, back to your point. So how you create, so I think, you know, that's interesting, but, you know, from our vantage point, Patrick and I mean, the amount of goodwill and the amount of interest for this to work, I think everybody understands that the metaverse is bigger than any single one company. So we feel there is a high level of energy. And so if we can contribute to catalyze the conversation, but there seems to be a unanimous agreement that GLTF is such a strong base. Got so many things right that, you know, Vlad Vukicevic from Unity was making the case of adding, you know, properties and attributes and start to get beyond the geometry. We talked to Martin and Ted from IKEA, who was telling us, you know, the look problem is, you know, through the 3D commerce working group, Now you can drop an IKEA piece of furniture. It will look the same mostly, or 99% the same in all renderers. So it's great to see that momentum. And, you know, and if you guys, the open source people, can also throw your weight behind it, I think it'll be, it'll contribute to the momentum.
Yeah, there'll be some interim pieces in between of what's actually happening. Like one of the things you brought up was when somebody pulls into a file format, it has to be converted and things like that, doing it kind of on the fly. But having it in an open source project where you have that kind of processor that can be severed away and made into its own node. I mean, if you remember, let's really rewind the clocks for a second. You remember when Web on Phone first came out? And we had that intermediate layer in between that would crunch the images and shrink the page down so you could get it across that super slow dial-up connection that they called cellular. You still had those processing nodes that helped get us over that hump. And we may run into that again where you have a lot of data coming from a lot of sources as you change experience to experience, or players that have intellectual property that's not on your system needs to be converted, brought in, operable on your system. I mean, we already know that you can throw your hammer down on one solid standard, okay, but that just seems to never really work because everybody has their own flight of it. And, you know, that's part of the game. But if you have a lot of the tools that people can actually do and drive forward that are shared, that can help really get it there. So it's not the fact of how will we get to the destination, but what are some of the tools that we're going to need to get us through those interim stages where they're not feasible right now because of what's been proliferated.
Okay, the last topic that we wanted to cover is around, you know, sustainability of open source. And like, you know, at Epic, we love open source. We're actually, we're supporting Blender, we're supporting Godot. And Royal, you need to ask. The way the program works, you need to ask. If you ask, you'll get a positive response, I can guarantee you. But we don't proactively go to people with a, we say, hey, please take some money. We're not there yet. So, but you know, sorry for the shameless plug, but I had to.
We'll talk.
But how do you sustain your endeavor? I mean, you say it's like a company. But it's a company, you know, with the revenue acquisition is a very different model. So how do you see scaling up open source initiatives and, you know, source, you know, how do you envision that? So maybe Juan, you know, what do you do to sustain your ecosystem? And, you know, you need a minimum amount of money, right?
Right. So in general, for Godot, it's very organic, I suppose. There's lots of companies or individuals that just donate. There's like many small people donating. There's many companies donating. There's like a couple of good amount of sponsors. So for now, on the monetary side, it's okay. Our problem is mostly that because of the nature of Godot, it's a very, very community-made thing. I mean, it's really difficult to describe, but it's very, very organic and very, like, many little guys doing something rather than a few bigger guys. So the problem is, like, for example, that what we try to do is before somebody is hired, we have a good amount of donations. So before somebody is hired, we try to look at which contributor is doing something the best, you know? And usually these kind of contributors really would appreciate that they can just quit their day job and just contribute to Godot like all day. And we know who the ones doing like the most productive or the best contributions are. So generally we try to look towards that, and then we offer them if they want to work for the project. And then we try to hire the ones. But we hire them to just so they continue doing what they are doing and just dedicate more time to it. It's not that we hire them to, okay, now we'll do something completely different, right? Because just by brute force, we have contributors working pretty much on everything. And everything that, I mean, it's so organic that everything that needs more work eventually is going to get somebody to do it. Again, just by brute force, just by sheer amount of contributors. So what we try to do is optimize that by just trying to finance the ones doing that, the work that they do really good, so they can continue doing it and doing it better. And that really works really, really well. It's completely different to how a company works. And I can tell you that because I own many companies in the past, and this is absolutely different. It took me a few years to understand how this ticks. And it's really, really different to anything else. So what we try to do is mostly finance the, I mean, there's so many working for free right now and doing incredible work that is, most of them are just donating their free time to the project and doing really good work and with the best intentions. But yeah, we try to use the donations to optimize their work, not really to have employees and tell them what to do, right? It's very, as I tell you, I mean, I'm not sure there's so many open source projects that work the way Godot works. I think probably Blender Foundation is similar to an extent, but because they are doing something which is more 3D modeling based, they don't have so many people contributing code to them. I mean, I understand for them it's more difficult to find people to do something specifically. But in our case, it's kind of the opposite. We have too many people who are doing things really, really efficiently and really well. And then we need to find like the sponsors who want to donate to make this work better, right? So it's a very, very interesting problem to solve. But very, very unique, I suppose, the way we do things.
So Juan, I'm super impressed with the contributor community that you've built there, and to have that many contributors. I mean, it just speaks to amazing vision, right? To have that many people rally around it. I'm curious, do you have even just like a ballpark idea of when you look at all the code that's been written? You know, was 20% of that funded and sponsored? Was 70% of it? Do you have any idea?
That's really difficult. I would say that nowadays, probably like 80% was not funded, was just contributed. Like there's lots of work that is being contributed. I mean, most of the work actually is, most of the bottleneck for us is reviewing the contributions because they already happened, we want it or not. In fact, we created a proposal system because we had so many contributions that we ran into a situation where we don't really know if this is something that we should integrate to the engine or not. So we tried to, I mean, we started doing like meetings with our contributors to decide whether this is wanted or not. And in the end, in most cases, we didn't even know. Like, do people really need this? They don't need it. So what we did is change it to a system where we have a proposal system. So now if you want to add something, you first create a proposal in a proposal repository. Then the community goes and can discuss proposals for months and agree what they want and how it needs to be added. And this is very interesting because now other contributors look at the proposals after the discussions were made and just create a proposal and contribute a pull request. And then we have to review it. And this worked really well for the past years. But now, again, the volume of everything, I mean, it's still scaled. Everything we do keeps scaling up all the time. So now we have like maybe 1,000 pull requests that we have to like go and review and see if they follow the proposal, if they are doing them properly. In most cases, they are probably not done properly. So we have to give them feedback on how it has to be done. And it's always a bottleneck on like merging things. We have too much code contributed and our difficulty is like making it into the engine in the highest quality as possible. Like we do a lot of automated testing and everything. So we are all the time like bottlenecked by how we integrate new things. Even if we try to filter them better, now we have a lot of very high quality contributions and now we have to filter them again. So it's very interesting. We try to find ways all the time to improve. I mean, every time we try to find a solution where one person is the filter, we fail because there's so much volume that we need to find ways. So all the time it has to like scale. Like when you do like compute programming and you need to scale it out of threads, like we need to find ways for the contributors to get things into in a way that is as parallel as possible and as high quality as possible. And that's super, super difficult. It's a really good problem, but it's very difficult.
Yeah. Well, I was about to say, what a good problem to have. So Rael, how do you plan to scale O3D both from a financial and community perspective?
So O3D came from the perspective that, for one, it's only been around for 6 months. So understand that the amount of velocity, the reason of why we actually pulled the companies and got the funding was so that we can create the marketing, so that we can create the awareness, so that we can actually get the resources, because we weren't looking at, I mean, we could do it in a traditional means where we give it a few years and let it kind of slow roll and build. But the demand was enough there that actually building it into the structure of what it is and getting the backing of companies and foundation, that was an essential part to really accelerating it quickly, getting faster adoption, more people on board. So it was really, a resource versus time thing. So, you know, we have a lot of people that are actually contributing now that are not part of companies. And we also have companies that are contributing. So when we have partners join, they don't just join where we go, hey, here's some money. They actually have to also contribute a project. which means they're contributing back at the same time, which helps the open source project. So for us, it's growing, it's building all of the structure that was in place to handle the scaling issues of what we know we're going to run into. When you have a community that's very, very enthusiastic and they're growing fast, you will run into those problems. So that's why we put a lot of that structure in place early to kind of prevent that. We're looking forward to the onslaught, and we're starting to get some of that. Because there's a lot of it happening. So our means of growth is really getting more people, getting it in their hands, working with the different schools, working with different companies, working with, you know, game jams, getting more open source, smaller projects that actually want to be able to do it, more demos, which in turn brings more people in to actually to work on this and contribute back. We have some people that are actually part of the community, which is funny. They have no interest in building a game. They have no interest in actually using the 3D side of it, but they have been the ultimate cleaners and ultimate code jockeys, going through line by line going, yeah, this needs to be rewritten, or this could be done better like this. And just, you see just continual requests from the community. And that's been tremendous, even at this early of a stage, 6 months out of the gate. So having those, tens and in some cases hundreds of thousands of lines that get changed in between iterations, it is tough when it can become volatile, and refining all that. And then you have a roadmap where so many things are coming in at the same time that it becomes difficult. But getting some kind of semblance out of it is critical. And that's been the focus of where we're at right now, which is taking a look at, here's all of our modules. Here's the maturity. If you want to build this type, you know that you'll need these particular features, modules, and things. Here's the maturity on them, so that if somebody from the community says, you know what, I know how to actually write that shader system, they can go in, look, and say, well, it's deficient or it needs more work, and they can write and contribute. Someone else can pick that up and run with it. So it's a matter of being able to expose where the weak spots are within it, coordinate them, and make them really visible so that we can have more people who want to build things on it be able to build that, and then have all the demo and materials behind it. So getting it funded is not a fact of hiring people into the project, because we haven't hired any engineers into the project as O3D. Everything that's come in is either through the companies who are already involved or through the community contributors themselves. The money itself is actually used to build community connections, awareness, training, and marketing. That's where most of the money actually goes. And of course, to maintain all the services so we can scale. So it's not used to develop core, but it's used to amplify. And the relationships with the companies are used with the community to help build core. And having that structure of being able to handle the scale is what allows us to be able to move at that pace. And so we're anticipating well ahead of what we're already seeing, and all of the trends that we see right now are exactly telling us. A lot of people are coming on board continuously. There's more and more people that are pulling the forks down, more people that are contributing back into the code. The PRs, I mean, we started with just a handful. We have thousands now. Where will we be in 6 months later from where we are now? Where will we be in 1 year? If we're tenfold to where we are now, I'll be terrified by the year after of where we're at. And that's when we're going to find out how good these systems and processes really work. But we'll be able to adapt and adjust to them because of all the different ways of it being used. So we've got a lot of big plans on how we'll scale with the community. And that's part of driving that balance.
Yeah, amazing. We tend to forget it's only 6 months old, this project, so despite the momentum. So we're going to try to wrap this up. But before, it's the usual question that we'd like to go through. Any topics that near and dear to our heart that you would want to cover or to have covered today? Like maybe Roy will start with you.
I mean, topics just really, for me, the big things are making sure that people understand that open source is all about sharing and about growth of working together. That's one of the biggest things. We're super grateful for all the partners that have been involved. I myself, I'm even grateful just, working at the Linux Foundation and working with them. The amount of things that I see and learn every day are tremendous. And my background, I come from the game industry. I've been in it for 25 years. I've got tons of software. I'm actually a developer by trade for well over 30 years. We're not going to talk about my age. But I've written a lot of these things and built all kinds of IP. But as an engineer, it warms my heart to see all of these people contributing their time and sharing as open source and finding ways on how we can work with other open source projects to make them better, to make ourselves better, and to working with different companies. So for me, that's really the biggest piece here is, you know, how do we all grow together and move forward without creating tribal knowledge or closed sandboxes?
Yeah, I fully agree with what Royal has said. I think one thing that we continually get asked at Godot is like, how do you compete with Unity or with Unreal or something like that? And the truth is that we don't really do any of that. I mean, we're just creating an open project where everybody who wants to contribute, contributes. And there's not really, we are not really aware of any roadmap from any company like Unity or Unreal. I mean, we don't really care. We are not really trying to sell anything. I mean, this is a community project where people very kindly donate their free time to create it. It has a lot of challenges. It has a lot of learning from our part on how this can work together. But for us, it's not really a competition or anything like that. In fact, I have noticed that, for example, like both from the Godot side, we have really, for example, implemented many things that Unreal and Unity have made because they are really, really smart choices on how they do things. But we also have seen how over time both Unity and Unreal have implemented things that were like inspiring how Godot to do things. So I think that in the end benefits the whole industry. So that's super, super positive to me. And the fact that we do something open source in general means that we are never probably going to be at the, you could say, forefront of trying things with innovations like probably like the way Epic does or the way Unity does, because what we do is something more, you could say somebody needs something, then it gets done with contributors and everything. And we are not really trying new things that may work or not work. So in the end, we are just trying to do like what people need. And you can probably see that in other open source projects. It's rare that an open source project is like trying to spearhead innovation, because we are not really investing and trying new things that may work or may not work. We are mostly like trying to create something that is community owned, that is done in a way like it's a very different type of development model to me. And we are not really trying to compete or anything like that. It's something that happens like on background while everything else is happening, I suppose. It's very, very different to me than you just can't compare it to anything else.
Yeah, and thanks for saying that, because I think it's a very important thing for people to understand about, you know, open source is not designed to be the forefront of innovation. It's designed to kind of drive commoditization and sharing and a common platform for everybody, and the commercial people, it's their job to innovate and be at the bleeding edge. So
I think that'll be the critical differentiator for engines in the metaverse, will be the innovators. They will stand out.
So Juan, any person or organization you want to give a shout out to today as we conclude this podcast?
Well, I wanted to thank all of you for inviting us. That has been very kind, and I enjoyed my time a lot here with all of you.
All right, Royal. So is there anybody that you are a person, organization you would like to give a shout out to today?
Well, for starters, to kind of reiterate, I would like to thank all of you here for having me. I definitely appreciate it. It's been fantastic. I really enjoyed when I got a chance to do it back in September as well. That kind of started off in this journey. I would say, you know, on top of that, I mean, really, the ones that started this journey would be over at AWS, between, you know, the Lumberyard team, Bill Voss, Andy Jassy, you know, from the Giddy App and Go statement, we actually took this out, because without it, it would have never happened. And it's been, you know, an insane journey, and all the partners that have joined in and contributed to this, and most importantly, the community, because they're the ones who are actually running a lot of the day-to-day. And without them, it wouldn't even be a project. It would be nothing. It would be like throwing code over the fence. So, you know, those are the biggest ones. And of course, the foundation for giving the ability to really to just drive and grow this. This is probably some of the most fun I've had in my life. And I've done a lot of weird things, even from my time at the Marines.
Well, thank you, guys. Thank you for the generosity. It was amazing. Thank you for your contribution to the open source movement. We know how important it is, and it takes a growing importance. You know, it will be such a fundamental element of the metaverse. So you guys are being that involved in the community. It's amazing to see. Thank you on behalf of everybody. Thank you for being there with us. Patrick, thank you. You know, we're seeing good momentum. We have good feedback on the podcast, so I think we're going to continue, right? You okay continuing?
Absolutely.
We have an amazing lineup of guests coming up. We had Bill Vass on the show regularly.
Did you?
He was very interesting. His perspective was very unique, interesting. You know, it's fascinating for us. We just, you know, holding the microphone in front of luminaries. So it's the simplest job I ever had in my life, but one of the most rewarding. It's good. So thank you to everybody who's listening. Please reach us on social if you have, you know, comments, remarks, rants, proposals, critics. We're open to everything, reviews. We want to continue to move the conversation forward to create an open and fair metaverse. So Juan and Royal, thank you. Patrick, thank you so much too. And thanks to everybody. We'll be back soon. Bye.